I think what we're going to do this morning is we're going to continue on with the red letter study. The red letter study has been going on for months now, but it kind of is our default position because, you know, whenever it's not Easter or Palm Sunday or like next Sunday, Mother's Day, it is Mother's Day next Sunday, right? I got that right. Good. Then we're going to come back and keep going with our red letter study, which is the study of Jesus' words that are sometimes printed in red ink in the New Testament in some editions of the Bible. And so we're just looking at his words. We have come up to probably my favorite part of the New Testament, which is the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Everything that you need to know about Jesus' teaching is contained in the Sermon on the Mount in three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Everything is there. You know, I like to use the analogy of those nesting dolls, matryoshkas, you know, the Russian nesting dolls, one doll inside the other. Because what we have in the Bible is, here's the Bible, that's the big doll. You open it up, and inside you've got another doll, that's the New Testament. You open that up, inside the New Testament, you've got the Gospels. Open that up, you've got the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew is special to me because it's the most Jewish of the four Gospels. Many scholars believe that Matthew was first written either in Hebrew or Aramaic and then translated into Greek, because it is so Jewish in its content and the way that it approaches issues and the use of language, untranslated words from Hebrew and Aramaic, just left untranslated in the Greek text. And inside the Gospel of Matthew, when you open that up, you have the Sermon on the Mount. And then even inside the Sermon on the Mount, you have the Lord's Prayer. So what you've got is this increasing distillation, this increasing density of the message, the entire message of the Bible and of the New Testament, concentrated down into three chapters, and even concentrated down into just the five lines of the Lord's Prayer. If you really look at the Lord's Prayer, you see it's all there, imprinted, just like DNA, imprinted there, and then it just grows into these other things that are all related to the parent itself. And so, what is this message? What is going on here? What is Jesus trying to tell us, and what can we understand? A lot of questions. Was the Sermon on the Mount even delivered all in one go? I mean, it's pretty amazing to have done that. Oh, they love these kids here. I think that's a good scream, isn't it? Yeah, that's a good scream. All right, we're okay. Jesus is delivering a message here. Did he do it all at once? Most scholars think probably not, because all of the material in the Sermon on the Mount is scattered throughout the entire Gospel of Luke in different places and in different scenes and localities and so on and so forth. So most likely what we have here preserved in Matthew is a composition, a compilation of both oral tradition, people just repeating the things that Jesus said, and early record keeping. There's ample evidence that there were early sayings, Gospels, just people writing down what Jesus said, writing down things he did with no narrative, no story in between, and those were brought forward and used as source documents for the Gospels. What we likely have in the Sermon on the Mount is one of those early sayings, Gospels, or even some scholars think an actual catechism that was used in the first century to bring new converts into the faith. All the teaching was right here, and it's laid out in a very logical order, very, very compositionally done. And so this is something that we need to pay special attention to if we're going to understand what Jesus was trying to tell us. But here's the catch. It is so Jewish in its demeanor. It's so Jewish in the way that it conveys truth that the church really doesn't know what to do with it. For 2,000 years, the church has had a hard time with the Sermon on the Mount, because the language is so giant. The language is so contradictory, even paradoxical. I mean, what do you do with the sections of the Sermon on the Mount that tell you that a thought is equal to an action, right? You know, you think you're okay if you just haven't murdered someone, but I'm going to tell you that even if you've had an angry thought, you're already guilty. You think you're safe because you haven't committed adultery, but I'm going to tell you that even if you look at a woman the wrong way, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. I'm going to tell you that if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. And in Luke, if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. What are we supposed to do with that? If someone slaps you on one cheek, you're supposed to offer the other? If someone asks for your coat, you're supposed to give your shirt as well? Now, these things defy our own common sense. These things don't even sound ethical to us. So what are we supposed to do with this kind of language? And then on top of it, to add insult to injury, Jesus tells us to be perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect. Oh, really? How's that working out for any of us, huh? How in the world can we do this? The church has often looked at these as impossible standards. Jesus was setting an impossible standard in order to show us that we cannot keep the law. In other words, to kind of break us over the back of the law so that we turn to God. But it's kind of a cruel joke when you think about it. The problem is that the church has been looking at the Sermon on the Mount through a legal lens. They've been looking at the sermon, we have been looking at the Sermon on the Mount as rules and commandments that we have to obey. And if we don't, then we don't get to enter kingdom. But we don't know what kingdom means either. And so the whole thing hinges on trying to understand what Jesus meant from a Hebrew and a Jewish point of view. Because Jesus doesn't give us impossible things to do. He doesn't do that. Jesus' whole ministry was encapsulated in his idea of the kingdom and the way. We need to understand what the kingdom is. We'll talk about that in a second. But this idea of the way, it was a way of living life. Jesus' first followers didn't call themselves Christians. That came later, applied by Gentiles, trying to distinguish them from the followers of Judaism, from which they sprang. So they called themselves Talmidei Orha, which means followers of the way. What way? Jesus' way of living life. Jesus' way of relating, Jesus' way of accepting and loving and connecting with the people around him. And there are several things that we need to understand about what Jesus is trying to get across that is really earth-shaking, really shattering if we take it to its radical conclusion. And in the first century, there were parts of it that were just as earth-shaking as they are to us, and other things that they had a handle on that we need to learn as well. Those of you who like to take notes, I'm going to give you 4 points. 4 points. Of the differences that Jesus is trying to get across in this sermon and in all of his teaching. The first one is that this way of living life, this way of relating to our Father in heaven is relational and not legal. Relational and not legal. In story after story, in teaching after teaching, Jesus is trying to ram home the idea that this is not about obedience. It's not just about following rules. It's about resonating with the King, about resonating with our God. At some point, when we are so in concert, so connected with our God, everything that we do looks like the law, but it has nothing to do with obedience. I'd like to say, if my 16-year-old son started to love his homework so much that he would just do it no matter what I said, you know, God be praised if that day ever came. But in what way is he still obeying my command to do his homework if he would rather be doing that than anything else that he could think of? It's the same thing with us. It's not about following rules. It's about connecting with our God, making his desire our desire, his values our values, and his purpose our purpose, and then everything flows from us. It's relational and not legal. So many of the things that we just heard right now, that I just told you about, murder and adultery and gouging out body parts and all of that, has to do with this shift from merely following rules and trying to skirt under the loopholes of the law and get across the finish line somehow, and really entering into a relationship, because a relationship is compromised, is broken with the first angry thought or the first wayward glance. Already, relationships have been damaged. Jesus is saying it's right there that the crux is. That's where we have to pay attention, because it's not legal, it's relational. The second thing is, it's about abundance and not about need. Abundance instead of need. This is huge for us. Because most of us start from the premise that we are less than. Most of us start from the premise that we are unworthy. Most of us are starting from an idea of original sin, which the Jews don't have, a concept of original sin. They are starting with the premise that what God made is good. What Jesus is telling us is that there is a God in heaven, our Father, who accepts us and loves us in such a way that everything he has is already ours. And if we are starting from a place of need, how does that color the choices that we make? If we are constantly trying to perform to a certain standard, if we're trying to raise ourselves up in order to be acceptable, how does that change everything we do and the attitude with which we approach life from saying that we're already accepted, we already have everything we need, and now we're free to give it away? Abundance instead of need. Now, these are two things that the Jews of Jesus' day really had to learn. They really had to understand. Because the Pharisees, over 200 years, had taken Judaism into a complete legal system. Everything was about the law. It was just like our tax code, if not worse, if you can believe that. And everybody trying to follow the law, like us trying to follow our tax code, we need to go to a tax preparer now because we can't figure it out. They had to go to the Pharisees and the scribes, who were the lawyers of their religious system, in order to find out if they were okay with God that day or what they had to do to get okay with God. And Jesus is saying it's not all about that. It's not about the lack that you have. It's not about the rules that you have to follow. It's about a relationship that's already given you everything that you need. There are two other aspects that the Jews understood culturally that we don't today, and we need to think about them. Because Jesus is telling us that his way is experiential and not intellectual. See, we here in the West want to think through everything. We want to be able to get a book. We want to get an executive summary. We want to get the how-to 10 list, and we just want to get it all down and just know we've got it and feel like we can make a risk-free decision at that point. She said, it doesn't work that way. You're not going to know what the way really is until you're on the way, until you're moving out, until you take those first few steps in total unknowing, at risk, and find out what is really true as you move forward. The truth that Jesus talks about that we can find that will make us free only comes as we follow his way, follow his commandments. It doesn't happen in advance. And so this truth that we're looking for is experienced and not thought through. Our heads get in the way. Our heads keep us from just allowing ourselves to move forward with abandon. And fourth, it's all about here now, and it's not about there then. See, the Jews understood this because in their culture, in their thinking, they didn't even have a clear concept of the afterlife. It wasn't their focus. Their focus was to do what they needed to do here and now. And because God was a just and loving God, everything would be taken care of in the next life if they just took care of this life. And so everything Jesus is pointing to is about this moment. It's about right here and right now. Yeah, but we think the kingdom is the heaven of the next life, right? The kingdom of heaven, after all. But it's not. When Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven, and we'll talk about the words that he used in a minute, he's talking about the quality of life that is available right here and right now. If what? If you realize that your life is relational and not legal. If you realize that it starts with a place of abundance and not need. If you're willing to just experience the things that come through your moments rather than trying to always think about them. All of that grounds you in this moment, and the quality of life that you experience because of all of that is what Jesus calls kingdom. And so the church has trouble interpreting Jesus' message because they're coming, and we have been coming traditionally, from this legal point of view, from this intellectual point of view, everything opposite to what Jesus is trying to get across. And it makes everything really difficult. But when we view Jesus' message relationally and let the legalities drop, then the difficulties dissolve. Because we realize that Jesus is not demanding obedience to an impossible standard. He doesn't do that. Not trying to break our back over the law. He's defining the nature of life in kingdom. This is what it looks like. This is how you relate. This is how it all works. The Sermon on the Mount is a picture of life in kingdom. It's pretty much that simple. Not about heaven, but about the quality of life right here and right now. And here's the key. This kingdom, entering this kingdom, living this quality of life, can only be attained by people who know, have experienced, that they're already accepted, already worthy, already loved, already given everything that there is to have that means anything in this life. The sermon is not law. The sermon is gospel. The sermon is good news. The sermon is this understanding of the real nature of things and the relation that we have. Because with law, it's man trying to reach God through his or her own efforts. But what is gospel? It's God reaching man and women with a free gift. And all we have to do is accept the gift that is freely given, and we experience something that sets us free. Free from what? Free from the fear that causes all the dysfunctional and damaging decisions that we make because of the fear that we feel. So here we go. Here's Jesus, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Matthew lays out the material in such a way that it's beautiful in the way that it flows. Have you ever heard the expression when you're going to tell someone something, how to build a birdhouse or how to balance your checkbook, that you first tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them? Have you heard that before? Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. Because you're giving them the whole overview. When you finish this course, you will be able to, build a birdhouse that looks just like this. Balance your checkbook. Do this and do that. You tell them what you're going to tell them. Then you go through all the steps and everything that they need to do, and then you recap it at the end to try to drive it home. This is what Jesus is really doing here. This is what Matthew is doing in arranging Jesus' message if it didn't come across this way all at once. In the first half of Matthew 5, Jesus gives us a picture of the final product. He's saying, when you have become a kingdom resident, when you are living in kingdom, this is what you're going to look like. And he gives us the Beatitudes. And because that you look like this, this is the effect that you're going to have on everyone around you. You're going to be salt and light. And in order to get this way, there are several things that you need to do. And the first thing is you need to redefine what you believe about the law. And the whole rest of Matthew 5 is refining and redefining the nature of law and how it works. Silence your cell phones. And then in chapter 6, he tackles righteousness, because the Pharisees and the scribes had very strict rules about what was righteous. Had to do with prayer, had to do with almsgiving, had to do with fasting, and all of these things they did in public. And Jesus is saying, wait a minute, it's not about that. It's not about climbing a social ladder. It's not about showing how righteous you are in the eyes of others. Let's redefine it. This is what it looks like. You pray in your closet by yourself, and you go here and you go there. He's trying to redefine that. And then in the final chapter, he gets really practical. And he shows us how all of these things can be plugged into the moments of your life. Specific ways that we relate, dealing with judging and dealing with different aspects of life. How does it work? And so it's all there in these three chapters. So now as we begin, and we want to dig in to the beginning of Matthew 5, we're going to be going right into the Beatitudes. And the Beatitudes are these short maxims, typical rabbinical way of getting points across in first century Judea. And Jesus is laying each one of these out. There's eight of them, and possibly a ninth, if it really was part of the Beatitudes. It's constructed the same way. But each one of these is giving us another facet, another look at the final picture and product of what it looks like to live in kingdom. So let's just read at Matthew 5, verse 1. If you've got your Bibles, go to Matthew 5. Otherwise, you can look in the programs or up on the screens. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountain. And after he sat down, sitting down is the sign of a teacher. You sit down to teach. His disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. And blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now all of these kind of roll off the tongue. We've heard them so many times if you've been studying the Bible. But what do they mean? What does this stuff mean? And more importantly, how does it help us when we walk out that door in a few minutes to make a different choice that is going to take us to a different experience that'll point us to the abundance of our Father in our own lives? If there isn't a one-to-one correspondence in what we read here and what we do there, then what's the point of study? How can we say that we have faith if there's no effect in our lives? And so this is what we want to do. When we read, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," what does that mean to you? Now, there are four operative phrases. We need to take a look at each one of them so that we can start to break down what Jesus is trying to get across here and what his first followers would have understood about what he was trying to say. You know, we need to understand what blessed means. We need to understand what poor in spirit means. We need to understand what the kingdom of heaven means. And we even need to understand what theirs is means. What about theirs there? Let's start with the second one, though, because I think that's the one that gives us the most trouble. Poor in spirit. What does poor in spirit mean to you? Anybody? Not a rhetorical question. What does it mean? No spirit, not a lot of it. Any other ideas? Yeah. That they don't believe in Jesus? Okay, they don't believe in God? Not well connected? Sad, depressed, lonely. Any others? Brokenness. Okay. 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 And then Luke, that's really, I think Renee read ahead. I have to give her a gold star here. She's moving in the right direction. But also, Luke makes it even more complicated because he just says, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom." So now, is it physical poverty? Is that what? But here's the thing. The way you all answered is the way that we always answer. Because what does it mean in English to us to think of the phrase poor in spirit? Of course it means a lack of something, because that's what poverty means, right? But how in the world are we supposed to be blessed if we lack spirit? How are we blessed if we don't believe? How are we blessed if we don't have any of these things that we would consider probably prerequisites, right? This is the problem that we face. We are reading a translation of an Aramaic thought form. Y'all know what an idiomatic expression is? An idiomatic expression is any expression in a language where you cannot get the definition of the phrase from the sum of the definitions of the words. Would that make sense? You can't just use the words and figure this thing out. And that's the problem here. Poor in spirit, meskina ruch in Aramaic, is an idiomatic expression. And just to bring the point home a little further, think about some idiomatic expressions that we have in our culture in English. How about easy as pie? It's a piece of cake. He's bent out of shape. Break a leg. Catch one's eye. Now, there's a great one. Imagine someone who has no idea, you know, about our culture, about our idiomatic phrases, and you just say, "This caught my eye." Now, try to picture that physically, how that works, see? This is the problem. It's kind of like it's raining cats and dogs, you know, and you're looking for quadrupeds falling out of the sky. Not only that, take this out 2,000 years, and you find this manuscript, and it says, "He caught my eye because it was raining cats and dogs," and you're saying, "What? How in the world can I deal with this?" You know? Hit the hay, hit the sack, pull someone's leg, rub someone the wrong way, shoot the breeze. Shoot the breeze. How would you translate that? How would you tell someone what that means? You cannot just get the definitions of the word. Under the weather, until you're blue in the face, wet behind the ears. We've got so many idiomatic expressions that we use all the time. And it's an agreement that we have culturally that we have decided and we have agreed that this is what these phrases mean. We know what it means to pull someone's leg, you know. But someone coming from another culture, from another language, they're going to take it literally and they're not going to understand. Just exactly the way we did with poor in spirit. We took it literally through the definitions of our own words and we missed what it means. This is an idiomatic expression. And what the Aramaic-speaking peoples agreed to in first century Judea was what it meant was an attitude of poverty, even if you're rich. Think about that. Regardless of your station in life, regardless of your possessions, you adopt an attitude of poverty, which means what? It means that you're humble. It means you're not aggressive. You're not domineering. It means that you are willing to be vulnerable. You're willing to be dependent. You're willing to be submitted. All of these things are what it means to be poor in spirit. It's not. It can encompass brokenness. In fact, usually it's a brokenness that precedes the ability to be poor in spirit. But you don't have to be sad. You don't have to be overwhelmed. You don't have to be in any kind of duress in order to be poor in spirit at the moment. It's a choice that we make to live our lives as if everyone is equal to us. They're not above us and we're not above them. We're all in the same boat together. We all find the connection point because we're willing to be submitted and we're willing to be dependent. And most importantly, we have learned to accept reality for what it is. Because what do we really have control over when it comes right down to it? And what do we really have power over when it comes right down to it? It's a recognition of the relationship that we really have with God. We are His children. We are His dependents. We couldn't take one step or take another breath if it weren't for God in the midst, God in the picture. We forget that sometimes. It's kind of like the two-year-old with hands on hips screaming no to mommy, you know? And we just kind of benignly just deal with it. But if for one moment mommy just said, okay, then you're on your own and out the door and shut it, it's that stark if we really take a look at the type of relationship that we have with our God. And so poverty of spirit is the only answer to the reality once you begin to see it. And so Jesus says, blessed are you when you are poor in spirit. And now we think of blessing as a transference of holiness from something that's holy to something that's not. If you grew up Catholic like I did, we blessed everything. We call the priest over and we bless the house and we bless our books and we bless our rosaries and our cars and we bless our children. We blessed everything. And we as Christians bless our food before we eat it. Why do we do that? Because we assume that it's not in a holy state and we want God to transfer holiness to it before we ingest it so that we can be holy as well. Now, a blessing to a Hebrew is a completely different thing. It has nothing to do with a transference of holiness. A blessing to a Jew is the permission, the ability, the allowance to partake in the abundance that is already there. When a patriarch, when a father blessed his son, his firstborn son, what he was saying to that son was, you now have the permission to partake of my estate, to run my estate in your absence. You have that permission. Jews don't bless their food before they eat it because there's nothing to transfer. They bless after they eat, and they don't bless the food. They bless God who gave them the food for allowing them to participate in the abundance. And so a blessing is a very different thing. But the word used here is not the actual word for blessing, berech in Hebrew. It's tovei. And tovei is related to the word for good, which is taba. In Aramaic, good isn't just a moral valence against some legal standard. It literally means ripe, as opposed to bisha, evil, which means unripe. And so here is this continuum between immature, unripe, unready, unable to perform to design specifications, all the way to the opposite, which is ripe and mature and in harmony in the right place at the right time. Tobay is related to that. And so you can translate Tobay, blessed, in all sorts of different ways. It can be enriched. It can be whole and complete. It can be balanced. You could even say, congratulations to you. Fortunate are you. Happy are you. And in many translations, you'll see all of those different ideas being brought across. But here's the beauty of Aramaic. It all happens at the same time. With one word, all of those meanings are layered up simultaneously. And a native speaker understands that. What Jesus is saying is, you are at the apex. You are at the peak of wholeness and completeness and fulfillment and health when you are poor in spirit, when you are living this attitude of poverty, regardless of your station in life. Because then yours is the kingdom of heaven. Now, this kingdom of heaven that we normally think of as heaven doesn't mean that, as we just said. Literally, if you translate it from the Aramaic, Malkutha Dashmaya, it would literally translate to the reign of unity. The kingdom is not a territory, it's not a place. It's the principles by which the king reigns. And what is that principle by which God reigns? Well, it's embedded in his name. Because heaven isn't about heaven. Heaven is a Jewish euphemism for the name of God itself. Shemaiah was used in place of using God's name because they didn't speak God's name. Just like you will use Gosh or Golly instead of saying God, you know, or Jeez instead of saying Jesus, by Crikey instead of Christ. We use these euphemisms ourselves, and so did the Jews. Shemaiah meant Alaha, meant God. And Alaha literally means unity. It means oneness. It means multiple things functioning as one. So the kingdom of heaven literally means the reign of unity. So enriched are you when you have this attitude of poverty, this humility, because then the reign of unity is yours. This is the last thing we need to take a look at. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Implies ownership, right? It implies that there is some sort of reward or some sort of payment for the things that we do, and now we're right back into a legal viewpoint. And that's the one that we want to get away from. So what is the way, even though this is translated correctly, what's the sense that Jesus is trying to get across here? And for that, we go to Matthew 19:14. And in the NASB, the New American Standard Bible, it's translated this way. Jesus said, "Let the children alone and do not hinder them from coming to me, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." This is the scene where the kids were coming up to Jesus to come and play, and the disciples shooed them. "This is a very busy man, very important, get away, get away." And Jesus says, "No, let them come to me, for the kingdom belongs to such as these." But here again, this idea of ownership, it belongs to such as these. But take a look at the King James translation. And there are many other English translations that translate it this way as well. But Jesus said, "Allow the little children to come to me, and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." Now take a look at the Aramaic, translated directly from the Peshitta. "Then Yeshua said to them, allow the children to come to me and do not hinder them, for of those who are like these is the kingdom of heaven." Here's the sense. When we are like children, when we are poor in spirit, we are kingdom. We are the living embodiment of all that kingdom is. We are living the kingdom. We don't own it. It can't be owned. It's not a thing. It is an experience. It's not a thought. It's a relationship. It's not a standard. It is a living, breathing experience in the lived moment that is like music. As soon as the last vibration ends, it's over. It only exists in real time. We are kingdom, for such as these are kingdom. When we are living along these lines, when we are experiencing these things. And so how would we translate this first, just this first beatitude? Back at Matthew 5:3. This is an Aramaic paraphrase, or paraphrase from the Aramaic. that I put together, borrowing heavily from other scholars. Whole and complete, balanced, healed, and enriched are those who are enriched. Let me start that again. Whole and complete, balanced, healed, and enriched are those who understand and accept their powerlessness, who live with a sense of vulnerability and gratitude, an attitude of dependence and submission, regardless of their station in life. For they are kingdom itself, the image of kingdom's fulfillment. Now that's something that we can use. Okay. It's in your bulletin. You see it right there? Okay, good. Steve is a great note taker. I watch him furiously there. It's so good. Now, this last one here, this is just the message, Eugene Peterson. But listen to the way he translated it. I love this. You're balanced when you're at the end of your rope. Do you love that? You're blessed, I'm sorry. You're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there's more of God and His rule. There is that notion of kingdom as God's rule, as His reign. When you're at the end of your rope, when you've exhausted all the things that you think that you can do, when you've exhausted all the stuff that makes sense to you, and you're there at that point, when there's less of you, there's more of God and His rule, that is a perfectly good way to translate this. It's got to make sense. It's got to make common sense. We got to be able to use this. We can't just have these lofty things up on a pedestal somewhere out in theory land. If it doesn't come in for a landing in our lives, if it doesn't get down to where we can use it, then it's no good to us. Jesus is very practical, very specific. He is always trying to get us to see the next step, the next thing that we can do. He's always trying to get us into the next place of unfamiliar territory. He's always trying to get us to hit that friction point, to realize that we're seeing something and feeling something that we hadn't felt before, because we're moving forward into this infinite Father, always experiencing something new. Every turned corner is a surprise. What would it be like to live life like that, where we're constantly being surprised? Well, if we don't expect that, it can be pretty annoying, I suppose. If we're living in fear, it's something that will keep us always at the edge of our seat. But if we can turn that corner and realize this is the experience of our lives, everything changes. You know, it occurs to me that the first step of AA is the same first step that Jesus gives us. To admit that we were powerless over alcohol or whatever drug of choice and that our lives had become unmanageable is the same thing that Jesus is trying to get at right here. Until we get to the end of our rope, until we get to the end of ourselves, until we realize that the strategies that we've put in place, that all the things that we have amassed in our lives to control the things and make us feel better and feel less risky, don't do a thing to touch what's really important in our lives, then we can't enter the kingdom. We can't do it. Because Jesus says we have to be talia, which is His word for child, but it also means servant at the same time. And when you combine the attitudes and the attributes of a child and a servant, what do you get? Poor in spirit. The same definition. Everything right there. Brennan Manning, one of my heroes. I've been reading his books for 25 years. He died just about 3 weeks ago. But in his book, Ruthless Trust, Richard Foster wrote a short foreword. And in the foreword, he was talking about how when his kids were little, every Saturday morning they made pancakes. And he was the pancake maker. So he'd go in and he'd be mixing the batter and pouring it out and doing all the things that you need to do. So there's all this stuff around. And all the kids were seated around the edges just watching Dad make pancakes. And every Saturday, you know, it was pancakes. And they looked forward to it. And he says, you know, come to think of it, I never saw my kids at the end of the meal taking pancakes and stuffing them into their pockets and trying to save them. Because, you know what, maybe Dad won't have any pancakes next Saturday. You know, maybe it's not going to happen. I better save a few against this rainy day. Because to his kids, Dad was just an infinite pancake machine. You know? The infinite purveyor of pancakes. There was always another pancake in Dad's pocket, and they didn't have to worry about that. That's the trust. That's the understanding. If we for just a moment could understand that there's always another pancake in God's pocket for us, what could we let go of? What could change? Not having to live up to certain rules in order to get a pancake, or to lose getting a pancake, to switch from legal to relational, to realize that it's not about what I can think about, but it's simply what I experience in God. Until I experience God's pancakes, I can't possibly know that they flow forever. And until I know that, I can't relax. I will always live in fear. This is the way of Jesus. This is the truth that he's trying to get us to understand. When you come back to the moment, when you really are present to the people around you and the situations that you find yourself in, you will learn a truth about the Spirit of your God. That's who he is. That connection, that warmth, that feeling of just baseline contentment that everything's going to be okay is who he is. And that truth will free us from all of the crazy things that we need to do. We live our lives holding on to pancakes, stuffing them into our pockets. We try to hold on to our youth. We try to hold on to our money. We try to hold on to our position. We use all the things we can do to erase lines and wrinkles and all that stuff because we're afraid that we're going to run out of pancakes. But life is not supposed to be lived that way. We are designed to live our lives in such a way that we grow old, that we get all wrinkled and pruny, that we spend all of our capital, that we just play ourselves out. That's the way we're supposed to live our lives. Like we said, I think a couple of weeks ago, your last check should be to the undertaker, and it should bounce. When we are all played out, when we have given everything there is to give, we are experiencing the flow of spirit. We're experiencing what it means to live in kingdom, and we are understanding the truth that makes us free. Let's pray. Oh, Father, thank you for being the provider God. Thank you for never running out of anything and always willing to give everything that there is to give. Help us to understand that it's only in the pouring out that we experience the reality of your truth and your spirit. Help us to always be in motion. Help us never to hold anything back, dam anything up. Help us to find in you the assurance that we need to know that we can give everything that we have to the person standing in front of us without fear, without the worry or the anxiety that we're not going to get back what it is that we need. There's always another party in your pocket. There's always another pancake on the stove. Father, help us to understand that to our core so that we can learn to live without fear and to give everything away and find in that moment who you really are and who we are as well. We know we can do this because you don't give us impossible tasks to do. Help us to persevere and help us to find you along the way. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.